Hello and welcome to CM Extra, the Capital Markets Exchange podcast. I'm David, and for today's show, we're taking a bit of a sidebar from the topic deep dives we've done so far on this podcast. So if AI on the trading desk and dealer wallet share are your bag, then take a look at our previous episodes. Instead, today, we're celebrating the industry's rising stars and meeting the next generation of trading leaders. If you'd like to do more meeting with trading leaders and peers, then do stay tuned, because at the end of today's show, we have some very important news. But let's meet the first of today's rising stars, head of global e-trading at Fidelity International, Sam Knight. Hello, Sam. How are you?
Hi, David. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. Delighted to be speaking to rising stars here today. Whereabouts are you based?
Based in London.
Ah, good stuff. So, based in London, Sam, tell us a bit about your role and what you specialise in.
Yeah, so I've been at Fidelity now for the last 6 years, been in the industry for 13. My current role is, as you mentioned, Director of Global E-Trading, which is a fairly new role that's been created. And that's to sort of oversee not just the low-touch trading side of the activity we do at Fidelity, but also the technology that sort of underpins it all. And I think it's this sort of this shift towards where, you know, technology is just increasingly important. So it makes sense to have one single voice from the trading desk when we're interacting with the technology teams to make sure we're spending our resource in the right way. So it's a sort of a joint role. That's one side of it. And the other side is I still sort of trade fixed income day to day. I've traded rates and credit for the last 10 years.
Right. And that technology, the role that technology plays, I think is going to be really important for us today. And leaning into that a bit, what was your journey into the role? What was it that attracted you to it?
Yeah, sort of like I imagine most people with most jobs, you sort of fall into these things. So I studied computer science at university. And then just looking for a job after that, you know, ended up with the banks because they were some of the biggest hirers for technology in the UK. So I started there at JP Morgan on their technology graduate scheme. I got rotated around a few places and ended up in the asset management, working on the equity trading desk, specifically on their order management system. And then one of their projects was to sort of rejuvenate or have another go at their automated equity trading system. So by chance, sort of fell into buy side trading, specifically automation. And it's sort of something I really, you know, I found really interesting, particularly the markets, particularly trading. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how my journey started. And then from there, there was an opportunity to become an actual trader, so to move from technology into fixed income trading. And that's where I spent sort of 10 years trading fixed income, had a shift to Fidelity, and then sort of bringing all that knowledge and experience with me. I kind of pushed for this, what we're going to talk about today, I think, mostly, which is this sort of low-touch trading platform that we're now currently using.
Yeah, bringing together those different experiences on frontline trading, but also from a technology and a product background has led you to where you are right now. And let's go right into that. So you have achieved a no mean feat of building out a low touch trading engine across asset classes at Fidelity, which is now being rolled out globally. Tell us a bit more about what that actually is, what the drivers were for that as well. And what can you tell us about how it works?
Yeah. So starting with the drivers, when I arrived at Fidelity in fixed income, I was trading rates at this point, which is the most liquid asset class and automatically lends itself to automation. But there wasn't a very sort of clearly defined process for how we go about low touch trading. So there was an opportunity there to actually create something from scratch. And also we benefit from the order management system we use was Charles River, which allows third party applications to interact with it. So, you know, from there, we kind of had this process. Okay, we want to build something that assists traders with trading. So it can take any sort of, you know, a couple of clicks, it can do that for you. And it's this sort of concept of any process that a trader undertakes, can we streamline it and automate it? And if we can, how can we do it with something that Fidelity owns and is proprietary? So it's been an evolution of small steps getting there. And now we have a sort of a single platform, which is the rule engine. The traders own the rules for their specific asset class, but all orders are basically evaluated when they arrive or when they change state, and a suggested execution strategy is presented to the traders should they choose to use it. And it's been that sort of process of building that platform, really, and allowing the traders to input their knowledge into it that's kind of, I think, has been so successful. So it's having that, the foundation is there, and it lets the traders specifically add what they want to for their asset class. And it's just dealing with the little quirks of the different asset classes. But fundamentally, the application you know, it works for everybody who uses Charles River, which is all of our trading desks globally.
And in terms of building that out across different asset classes, I guess there'd be different ways of doing that, focusing on an asset class and focusing on a platform, a product that would enable this low-touch trading across all asset classes. Why did you decide to go one, which the way you went, you might think is more challenging, versus going with a single asset class and rolling that out globally?
I think that's a benefit of, one, my experience started with equities and working in technology. So I saw, you know, they were much further ahead, I think it's fair to say, than the fixed income markets. You know, they were already doing this automation. And then when I went to fixed income, so much of what they were using was applicable to the fixed income role. It's just, you know, a slightly different flavor of the same thing. So from a technology standpoint, I was like, the fundamental technology that underpins all this is exactly the same. It just needs to be changed a little bit to make it work. So if you can build something that works for everybody from the very beginning, you sort of get this scale that I didn't think, you know, we certainly didn't have it at JP. They were large enough and had the resources that they could have multiple different teams working on this side by side. But at Fidelity, right, which I think is more sort of a traditional asset manager, it's still large. You know, we are resource stretched. So this ability to have it across asset classes is where the value comes in, because it's all roughly the same sort of thing that we're trying to do.
And I'm sure that there are other firms that are looking at similar things and have already rolled out similar things. That thing of kind of one size fits all, the extension to that sometimes is one size fits all fits no one. So yeah, were there any compromises that you had to make in making it applicable across asset classes? How did you prevent that from adding more complexity to the product? And I guess I'm asking you this not only from a trading point of view, but also with your product manager hat on as well.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest difficulty. So if you build a foundational platform, it doesn't quite work for everybody. So everybody needs it to be tailored slightly. And then as soon as you allow certain asset classes to tailor their workflows, you lose that sort of scalability. So that is the big trade-off. It's saying, okay, let's just think of an example. So let's think about if you want to split an order, or there's multiple orders on the blotter for the same instrument, you know, those need to be treated in a certain way, but different asset classes might treat those orders in a different way. So again, you have the flexibility to allow people to input certain blocks of logic which are specific for them, and then they can sort of, you know, add that block of logic into their workflow, and the framework that allows it to operate, you can sort of have that block of logic for somebody else. So with the example I just gave, what do you do if an order arrives on the desk and you're already trading the same order? That instance pops up across asset classes, but the actions after it will be different. So the logic that sort of allows you to do something with that is the same, but the output is slightly different. So it's building these fundamental blocks and really thinking back, whenever you have a problem, does anybody else have this problem? How can we make it so we're tailoring it the smallest amount possible, but allowing everybody else to use the same functionality? I hope that was a kind of way to describe it, but it's all about this microservices. So boil everything down into the simplest you can, and then let people tailor it as basically as little as possible.
Yeah. Key to that, I think, is an understanding of the challenges of the specific cases that different traders trading different things in different places might come across. And it strikes me that you have both of those sides of understanding. You've got the technology, the product, the microservices approach to it, but also the specific trading insight as well, to almost be able to preempt some of those challenges. Would that be a fair thing?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I've said when I was in technology, I used to say the business users get the technology they deserve, not the technology they want, because it's all about how much you know, because I was sat on the other side of the fence. They'd come to me and say, I want this, but then they would sometimes just struggle to get the information you need. Whereas I've fortunately sat on both sides of the fence, and, you know, I need to shout out the technology team, and particularly a couple of business analysts and developers we have at Fidelity. You know, I spend, I would say, just hours and hours and hours with them over the last 6 years, just talking and helping them understand the trading workflows and helping me understand the technology that you have available. And it is that communication between us that sort of allows this to operate. Mm. And then more broadly, you know, when we're thinking about the trading here, I always say there's two sides to automating trading. There's first, there's what should we trade? So So what yep. is good to go right now? And then the second one is how do we actually execute it in the most efficient way possible? And by far the most difficult part there is solving for the what to trade. So a human's very good at saying, here's an order. I know I can trade it now because the PM wants to, or there's a fund flow that needs to be done at a certain time. That's very hard to code up systematically. So a lot of the focus has been on the sort of how do we build something that fits the Fidelity order flows? And then the second part of that's all about how do we execute it? So yeah, it's been a journey.
It's been a journey, and I guess my final question on the implementation part of it is, having been involved in a number of big rollouts of technology across trading financial services and elsewhere as well, change is difficult, and bringing in automated systems, there's the people, the process, as well as the technology. So how has the kind of human side and the process side of this technology rollout been from where you've sat? How have you ensured that the implementation of this across the estate there at Fidelity has gone as smoothly as possible?
Yeah. And this is the key one, especially when we're talking about automation. And the main thing there is, ultimately we're trying to build tools that help traders with their day-to-day job, not necessarily replace them. And I think, we're seeing that. So the order that are going through it, they are the simple ones. There's lots of tickets, very small sort of notional or risk, and it frees up the trader's time. So I think they understand that. So that's an education purpose. And the second one is we've brought them along from day one. So nothing is done behind the scenes and then just rolled out. There's constant sort of announcements and updates and interactions mm-hmm. with the desk. And the way we built this is each trading pod owns the rules. So we own the technology, but they own the rules that define what is low touch and what isn't low touch. And we'll provide them with data and, insights, and where they can change things. But ultimately, it's their responsibility to say, I'm happy. We want them to know when they click that button, they know exactly what's going on behind the scenes. So I think it's just that education and conversation, and you bring them along with you. So that's been vital to it.
And from as we look to the future, from low touch to one touch and zero touch, how do you see the future of trading and automation and this move towards fewer and fewer, if any, touches?
Yeah, it is an interesting one. So the difference between one touch and no touch in terms of a productivity gain, it's not actually that much. There's not much of a time saving between one and no touches. But it does just mean you sort of have this systematic flow, which arguably you can measure in a slightly different way. I think it's inevitable, first off. The sell side are doing it and the buy side can follow where the sell side go typically. So, it's best to sort of dip your toe early and really learn from the sort of small automation right now. So when, there are further pressures or Fidelity is a growing business, we want to do more tickets, we want to do more trades, that will give us the ability to scale. So I think it is inevitable, and I think we should be taking those first steps forward. But the key is with all of this is not making sure you don't lose out on anything. So a lot of the traders say the small tickets influence the bigger tickets. It provides them with market information. So, they can see who's pricing what, how things are being traded. So I think it's just vital that when we're doing no touch, we're still presenting that data back to them so we don't lose any of that insight. Yeah. But ultimately, I think, automation's coming. Most people respect that, and most people actually want to, they can see that it has a positive impact on their sort of day-to-day workflows. So, again, conversation, bring people along with the journey.
Yeah, and the transparency, still providing that reporting, even on the zero touch.
Definitely.
Final couple of questions for now, Sam. Look, it's quite an achievement. Congratulations. How do you feel about it? How do you reflect back on your journey so far? Because from starting off in tech land and then moving into trading and then bringing both of these things together to achieve what you have, that feels to me like quite a journey. How do you reflect back on it?
Yeah, I guess I've just been sort of, I always say nothing's ever been sort of one big delivery. It's always been lots and lots of small steps. So when I kind of look back over 6 years of where we've got to, it's actually come quite a long way. But, the month to month, the sort of grind of, making sure you've got resources, it's felt like a long road. But no, I'm super happy with where we've got to. I'm just also happy that, we built a product for fixed income that I thought would work for our flow. And I was optimistic it would work for everybody else. And I was just happy that when the other asset classes and desks evaluated all the tools out there, different EMSs, they said, actually, what we have internally is going to be, beneficial for their workflows. So it's nice to have a bit of a validation there. And then what comes with that validation is, increased awareness and hopefully increased resource. And, this role that I was fortunate enough to get, that's come off the back of it. So it kind of shows, just keep plodding along and you'll end up. Yeah, time flies and you'll end up with a relatively decent product. So optimistic for the future.
A marathon is a series of sprints, after all. Finally, something that we're asking to all of our rising stars today. If you could give any piece of advice to yourself on your first day on the trading floor, what would it be?
Yeah, I guess three things for me. First one is always be curious, constantly be curious, constantly seek out, say yes to things, you know, get exposure to other areas. Something I say to all the grads and everybody I've ever sort of mentored or had time is nail the day job. Make sure you're the best at what you're supposed to do for the company right now. And that'll give you the sort of credit when you want to push for sort of other aspects or, you know, resource for side projects. Make sure you, you know, the day job is nailed in. And then the final one is, which has worked for me, is, you know, be entrepreneurial. I try to think of everything that I do as, you know, I'm like a business within a business. So the automation platform is I'm trying to sell it to the other desks in the company. I want them to be users. You know, when I do other sort of internal projects, again, it's always how can I build something that I think is, you know, marketable internally. So I think those three things are, you know, sort of I've tried to live by.
Sam Knight, Head of Global E-Trading at Fidelity International. Thank you very much for joining us on CM Extra.
Thank you, David.
Our next rising star for today is Managing Director and Co-Head of Trading at Campbell & Co, Dave Beiser. Hello, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, David. How are you today?
I'm really good, thanks. Whereabouts are you joining us from?
Joining from Baltimore, Maryland. I, as you said, co-head of trading with Campbell & Company. We're a systematic manager here in Baltimore.
Okay. What do you specialize in there, and what was your journey to get there, and what is it that keeps you there?
So I've been with Campbell 15 years now, over 15 years, and in my current role as co-head of trading, I predominantly manage all things related to our OTC trading, so think interest rate swaps, foreign exchange. My co-head, Nicole McLean, manages all things on the listed side of the business. Campbell has DNA in both products, so we're deeply involved in both products. You know, and as far as, you know, what keeps me there, I kind of have three main points to make on that, and really all of them are equally important. But what I would lead with is that, you know, very firm believer in, you know, our end product. being a systematic hedge fund, what we offer really can be, you know, complementary and additive in the broader context of investment allocation. Of course, like any investment, it needs to fit from a risk profile and time horizon standpoint. But I would say that gaining exposure to a broad array of systematic strategies like those that we offer can be incredibly valuable. I would say that truly believing in our offering helps to keep me here. Second quick point is that I just feel very fortunate to work with some extraordinary people, and I genuinely enjoy coming into work each and every day. You know, most importantly, my colleagues and the leaders around me are genuine and good people. They also understand the needs of our clients, which of course relates to the first point I made. And then on the research and strategy side of our business, they know what it takes to rigorously pursue new investment opportunities, and then our management and investment teams know how to implement and integrate those new opportunities within the, you know, our broader risk management context. And then the last thing I would love to say, and, you know, now touching more on my day-to-day with my team in the trading department, but being a part of the broader trading ecosystem is extremely exciting. You know, it's often said that no 2 days are the same in the markets, and while that may be true, markets are ultimately a function of human behavior. At a high level, it's, you know, just fascinating watching themes play out from a macro standpoint. Yeah. And then at a more, you know, nuanced level, it's also interesting and rewarding making changes to how we interact with the markets, how we improve our trading outcomes, and ultimately seek to get best and better executions for our clients. What keeps me coming back is, you know, I'm a strong believer in what we offer. I love the people we work with, and I continue to be, you know, fascinated by our markets and the challenges that they present.
Teamwork makes the dream work, and it certainly helps when you're working with colleagues and customers who you, A, get on with, but B, who you've got that good mesh of trust there as Absolutely. Well, supporting one another professionally and personally when times are tough. Doing more with less, that's a theme that we talk about a lot across many industries at the moment, including here in capital markets. How does your structure, how does your desk at Campbell & Co. support that theme of doing more with less across the different assets that you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. So my belief is that the trading team and the trading system and its various connectivity points are a crucial part of the lifeblood at an investment firm like ours. So whether you have a fully automated execution process or whether you're trading, more high touch markets, the same thing is true for those sort of opposite ends of the execution spectrum. Traders are the connectivity to the street and the liquidity providers. And they're the natural ones to consume the information and see the data come through, and for that matter, have the understanding of what is the most relevant information and data. Of course, a trader may not be able to consume, parse, and utilize it all by themselves. We all know that's not possible. But traders can facilitate the conversations about how to utilize said info and data. And this can be true whether it's, to be consumed upstream at the idea generation level or utilized downstream at the more execution and post-trade analysis level. And let's be clear on that last point, kind of paramount importance for our trading team is achieving best execution and the best trading outcome possible for our clients. That's always the number one goal. But the rule we have always lived by, and it's something that's often said in forums like this one, is that the best execution goal is part of a broader process rather than just one isolated outcome. And that's important to stress right now. And I say that, now kind of circling back to the original question, in this hyper-competitive environment in which we're all operating, traders are resource constrained. And generally speaking, the recurring theme in our world, teams are doing more with less, as you said.
Yeah.
And not only are trading teams resource constrained, but oftentimes firms like ours across, the entire business feel resource constrained. So, in addition to our mandate for best execution, I also believe the trading desk should be thought of as sort of a broader risk mitigator function around the firm in that we're doing more with less.
Okay, so in terms of that risk mitigation piece then, what do you have in your arsenal there to kind of mitigate risk for the firm and still add value perhaps?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Something near and dear to our hearts. And I think that it's something that is often overlooked by people that don't understand how firms like ours operate and how they're kind of maturing and changing in this ecosystem. Traders not only have a pulse on the market and are part of sort of the collective intelligence from a portfolio management standpoint, but we also manage every aspect of our liquidity provision, which is incredibly important. Execution can become increasingly automated, which is a fantastic goal and something that we can get into, but still our connectivity points are managed through really an increasingly larger set of relationships. And these relationships need to be cultivated over time. They need to be monitored. You need to have these regular touch points with those relationships. And that aspect of our business is never going away. Regardless of automation, it's extremely important on the listed side of our business, and it's especially important on the OTC side of our business as well. And then also from a risk standpoint, traders are the ones that interact with some of the firm's most crucial technology. At Campbell, we take technology risk extremely seriously. We have extensive vetting processes for new providers. We have a rigorous testing process whenever changes are made or processes are changed or added or, new providers are brought into the mix, regardless of, kind of where they fall in the tech stack. And our traders are heavily involved in all aspects of this testing process. I'd even say that the modern day trader needs to kind of always have on their PMO hat when they are interacting with their respective trading technology. You know, nothing is constant in our world, and you know, since we're always changing and we're always looking to improve, traders need to know how we can improve our tech stack and then facilitate and manage the conversations with our developers and really the true technology experts. And then just the last thing I'd mention here, David, on the risk mitigation standpoint is, you know, credit and admittedly the very broad topic of counterparty risk. So not only does the trading team manage relationships with our banks and the non-banks and the broader spectrum of liquidity provision, but we also manage and vet relationships with the various clearing provider and folks in prime services groups. You know, our best execution committee diligently monitors counterparty risk, but it's the traders that facilitate both our systematic approach to this monitoring and are also the ones who have the regular touch points with our clearers and our and the execution providers. So whether it's taking stock on the health of the ecosystem or ensuring that we have competitive financing rates, this is just yet another example of the crucial part of the broader business that a trader can manage from a risk standpoint.
I want to move on to automation just to make sure we can cover all the bases that I want to cover in the time we have there. You mentioned automation a few times. You mentioned that a beautiful closed loop system, understanding from the developers of the technology stack all the way to the traders at the sharp end of that, ensuring that there's a feedback loop throughout that. So you end up with the best implementation of what it is that you're trying to go with there. In terms of automation, I know that's something you've been leaning into. How do you see automation really transforming this trading landscape, and what specifically can you say about how you've been able to implement automation strategies to try and keep ahead?
So what I would lead with on that question is there are several things that need to be explored before a trading team can efficiently implement automation into their execution workflows. First of all, you need to have a thorough understanding of the liquidity with which you expect to interact. And you need to have some sense of cost and some expectations for things like market impact. Obviously, these are, you know, very broad sweeping statements, but that concept really is the crux of the matter. And then the second point there, and it goes along with you know, the previous point on cost expectations, is you need some element of contributing data, of course. Yep. And while in trading, you know, more data is better than less data, it's also important to clean and manage the data to most efficiently utilize it for, you know, whatever your specific purpose is. You know, garbage in, garbage out, that's the cliche, but of course it's true. There are countless ways in which investment firms can utilize data to improve their execution and to integrate those various means of automation into their, you know, their trading processes. And I did want to touch on liquidity. We work extremely closely with all of our liquidity providers, and especially our bank partners. You know, the landscape may be changing a bit, and sure, there are non-bank liquidity providers stepping in to fill the role in certain instances for us. But the partnership we have to have with the banks will always be important. And this is more in the frame of automating. You know, with those conversations, we have, you know, different focuses and goals from the banks. So we, you know, to some degree are limiting, of course, what we are sharing with them. But what I just want to stress is that it is important when you're able to leverage their resources and the knowledge that they have of the microstructure of the markets. There are instances where it can, you know, help the buy side trader achieve best execution, improve automation capabilities, and at the same time, this back and forth feedback may also help the bank make prices, and it kind of improves the whole ecosystem, really. One of the fundamental issues of a buy-side trader, really, is that we only have so many parent-level trades in which to analyze outcomes on a truly observable ex-post basis. This is a challenge. Banks at the franchise level have more of that data. So there are a lot of things, not everything, but there are a lot of conversations and there are a lot of things that make sense to outsource to them, and they can realize value in ways we wouldn't necessarily be able to do on our own. Whether it's their own observations or doing some degree of A/B testing, there are a variety of things that can be can be monitored. And just, you know, throwing out a few examples, perhaps a provider believes that they can make tweaks to their matching engine to improve how they consume liquidity, ultimately giving the end user a better fill. And of course, it depends upon your objective. Or maybe the trader wants to speed up a trade that they want to automate, given they don't believe it will have significant market impact. You can discuss posting liquidity, the frequency with which you repost. I also think it's valuable to leverage our counterparts when discussing venue analysis. You know, this is mostly true in FX and equities, but interacting with lit or dark venues and observing the market impact is crucial when you think about interacting with that type of liquidity provider on an automated basis. And to be honest, most of the examples I've thrown out and discussed can be handled, you know, with or without working with this type of counterparty. But again, leveraging the franchise knowledge, especially when it comes to things like microstructure, can help provide with some of the information that we need to improve our trades and to implement automation.
Sure. Dave, we've got time just for one final question in our chat for now. And it's a question that we're asking all of our rising stars today. And it's, what's the one bit of advice that you would give to your younger self? Maybe a piece of advice you could pop into an envelope now, chuck in a time machine, and it's something that younger Dave would open on their first day on the floor. What would be in that envelope?
So when you're young in a new position, I believe there's a balance to be, you know, struck of, you know, putting your head down and working hard while also continuing with the exploration of new opportunities so you can have some degree of optionality in your life. We all know optionality is valuable. And I'm not necessarily just talking about role changes or switching companies, but learning, certifications, education, networking, all that stuff is extraordinarily important depending upon the circumstances. But what I would tell my younger self is that with hard work and exceptional work, it's easier to find those opportunities and have that optionality. And really, it ultimately was the path that I took, and I've only been with two organizations in almost as many decades, but I certainly got myself real stressed out about it early on. I would say that the hard work side of the equation, particularly early on in your career, can still help get you to where you want to be.
Dave Beiser, Managing Director and Co-Head of Trading at Campbell & Co. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Pleasure chatting with you, David. Thanks for having me.
And our next rising star today is Vice President for FX Electronic Trading and Market Structure Analyst at T. Rowe Price, Brendan McMurtry. Hey, Brendan, how are you doing?
Doing well, David. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm detecting that you may well be dialing in from the US. Whereabouts are you?
I'm based in Baltimore, Maryland.
Another Baltimore caller today. Fantastic. Lots of rising stars in Baltimore. It seems. Tell us a bit about what you do and what you specialize in at T. Rowe Price.
Yeah, sure. So I focus on FX electronic trading, which has a few facets to it. So analytics, electronic trading protocols, automation, and trading technology.
Right. What was your journey to being in there, and what keeps you there now?
Yeah, so I actually joined T. Rowe Price about 9 years ago out of school. I studied chemical engineering in undergrad, and we had a quantitative analyst rotational program. And I quickly learned through that I wasn't necessarily cut out for more of a pure quantitative research role. It reminded me a lot of being in a laboratory, and I had no intent on getting my PhD, so I had a lot of fun in trading as part of that rotational program. I really appreciated the dynamic, fast-paced environment, the fact that there's a new challenge every day, and really love the innovation and high-stakes decision-making that goes on in trading. Right now, I would say what continues to attract me is just being able to continue to learn new skills and just broaden my knowledge base, as well as mentoring some of the younger associates.
Enjoys the high stakes environment. I like that a lot. But also having an understanding of yourself, having got on one journey and then said, actually, do you know what? Maybe I need to take this fork in the road. And that's certainly a fork in the road you've taken. Now, Where I want to lean into today is data-driven. It's been a mantra across this industry, of course, as well as across many others as well, but for a little while now. Talk to me about what data-driven, what that's meant for you, and the different ways as you see it in your role that data can be used to drive different types of decision-making.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a great question. So a lot of people, when they hear data-driven trading, they think about the actual point of execution. They think about trying to optimize how they're actually going to execute something. So in the case of FX, a big question is, do you use a algo for a given trade? Do you trade at high touch? Do you trade at RFQ? But the thing I try to highlight to people is that the ways in which data can impact trading decision making, it's multifaceted. So it's not just how to trade, but it's also where to trade, when to trade, how much to trade, even what to trade. And so I believe that with all of these decisions, you can use data and analytics to augment those. And then another key thing that I want to highlight is that our goal is really to elevate human expertise and judgment using data and analytics, not replace it. So I was just thinking about some examples related to this, but it's actually marathon weekend in Baltimore. There's going to be a number of road closures around the city. But if I was going to go and plan out the time to leave and a route using a GPS, I could almost bet you that they are not reflecting that data yet in their algorithms. And so therefore, I know that in this case, I need to adjust my plan or use different search criteria when using the GPS. So in normal conditions, quote unquote, these kinds of tools can work great, but there's always the opportunity for a human to add judgment and expertise in a certain situation to add value. So if we think about it, more trading specific examples, sure, we might recommend a specific algo that's designed to operate in normal liquidity conditions. But if you know an event's coming up or some news just came out, then a trader needs to adapt accordingly. And in those cases, I would much rather trust the human's expertise in that situation. Lastly, the thing I want to highlight is that what underpins all of this is kind of a culture of continuous improvement and an unwavering focus on refining our processes. So it's a multi-stage process where it comes down to making incremental gains over time, and that really compounds on itself.
A couple of things there, and this kind of rubs shoulders with a whole AI conversation as well, and that framing around what AI actually means. Artificial, of course, is one A in there, but there's also augmented and automated. And I think you touch on there, it's not automation replacing human decision making, but it is augmenting it. But it's still the humans who have the insight of the fact there's a marathon in Baltimore this weekend, or there's a news story that might well affect whatever it is. Understanding that is absolutely key. You mentioned the fundamentals there as well. And whether it's artificial intelligence, augmented, automated, whatever you want to call it, or data-driven decision making, I think that the other platform there is getting the data sources themselves right. Understanding what data is needed, what data is most valuable to help you make the decisions, whatever they are. So from your point of view, what's been your approach to understanding those data sources, making sure you know what should not be going into the data lake or whatever you call it in your shop?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. Again, I would go back to the point that the use cases for using data and analytics are multifaceted. So it really does depend on the given use case. So, you know, in certain situations, we might need data related to specific portfolios and their positions. In other cases, that data might not be relevant. But what I would say is that we kind of have like our core of our data model, and that really is transaction or trading data that has been processed by our primary FX analytics vendors being BestX and TradeFeeder. As part of this, we also incorporate some high-level statistics around market conditions like volatility. But just thinking about the future and where we want to take it, we want to basically contextualize the information as much as possible. So some additional data sources that we're looking to add are additional granularity around market conditions, things like market activity or volumes, which for FX practitioners is a particularly sticky or difficult problem given the OTC nature, order book imbalances, order book depth, economic indicators like data releases, central bank announcements, and then any sort of additional signals that could add value in predictive analytics use cases. So things like momentum, flows and holdings, market sentiment, geopolitical risk. The thing that I would say as far as the second part of your question, as far as what data sources not to include, the thing I would always highlight to people is that more data doesn't always equal better data. Yep. So you really need to validate the use case, the quality, and the ROI that you're getting on those data sources. The other thing you have to consider is like the scalability and the ability to integrate those data sources. So if it's overly complex relative to the signal it adds, you know, if you have to go through this whole process of structuring unstructured data to integrate it within your decision-making systems,
yeah,
it's probably not worth it relative to getting more value out of your existing data sources.
But data isn't cheap. Trust me, I used to work for a data provider, and I know how much it can cost you guys. So I guess it's that balance, isn't it, between understanding really where the data, the types of data where you feel that you are able to get that best return on investment, balancing that against the budgetary constraints that you've got, and also maybe being creative or even using what you've got as effectively as you can be. There's a few different plates, different axes that you're spinning those plates on, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the first thing I would highlight to people is just focus on leveraging your existing data sources as effectively as possible, whether that's through things like feature engineering, changing the actual design of your systems to improve your predictive capabilities. There's actually like a really recent example where OpenAI has just launched their newest large language model, the O1 model. And they're using the same exact data sources, but they've made this fundamental design shift where they're using chain of thought reasoning and reinforcement learning, which I don't need to nerd out too much on that stuff right now. But what they've seen is that for reasoning and complex decision-making tasks, that it's actually a step change in terms of the benchmark scores for the model. So that I thought that was a really great example of basically using the same data, but changing the design of the system and getting this actually massive, significant improvement in performance. So that's the first thing, is just being more creative with your existing data sources. But for new data sources, it's all about ROI. We've been in talks with a market data provider for a while now, and we've done this rigorous analysis around how much value can it add relative to the cost and the complexity of integration.
Of course, there's the sexy side of data when it comes to the, yes, we're going to automate this, all of the good stuff. But there's also the non-sexy side as well, and you touched on it earlier, but that's also vitally important, and it's the data quality piece. And as we said in tech circles for decades, garbage in, garbage out. So how do you approach avoiding garbage data to make sure that you've got not only the right data that we've spoken about, but it is the right quality data to enable you to execute whatever decisions you're making as best as you can?
Yeah, so I think within the FX space specifically, we've done a lot of work around being very deliberate with our data quality frameworks. Just to your point, I would definitely just highlight to people that this is the most foundational element to all this stuff we're talking about. So kind of an analogy that I came up with is, if you think about, like, if you go to a really nice restaurant and it's a professionally run kitchen, there's this concept of preparing all of your ingredients and organizing them prior to the meal called, it's also known as mise en place. And this isn't like a very glamorous or exciting thing to discuss, much like data engineering. So what everyone really focuses on is like the quality of the meal and not really the prep work that goes on behind the scenes. So much in the same way, if you go to undertake analytics projects without this foundational underpinning, sure, you can maybe make some of the meals, but the quality is going to be all over the place. And not only that, but I think a lot of stakeholders within trading don't really fully recognize or appreciate this. So, you know, in the restaurant example, it could be a diner, or even a restaurant owner, and they don't realize how important mise en place is. And yet, like, the best chefs know that you need to have this process in place. Otherwise, you're going to have all kinds of mistakes and disastrous service. So it's kind of a hill that I am willing to die on, is that this is super important, and it's not the most glamorous or sexy thing, but it's the most important when it comes to success in this area.
I hope that stakeholder was a deliberate pun that you put into the mise en place restaurant metaphor there. But you're absolutely right. It's about ensuring that the output is good, but also it's about consistency as well, that whether you are dining on a Friday night or dining on a Tuesday afternoon, you have consistent output. And that consistency of the input is also vitally important as well. Listen, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you a question that we're asking all of our rising stars here today. If there was a piece of advice that you could magic back in time and give to yourself on the first day of your job on the trading floor, just whisper it into your ear, what would you be whispering into younger Brendan's ear?
I think the biggest thing is, especially in an environment like trading in capital markets where, you know, it's pretty intense. There's a lot of really ambitious people in the space. I would say to really just focus on the skills and the knowledge that you can gain out of any sort of challenge that you face, and not necessarily just a given outcome, whether that's getting a project done, getting a particular promotion, or getting some sort of recognition or credit for your work. Because at the end of the day, all those things are somewhat or very much so outside of your control. And having this kind of process focus kind of counterintuitively actually leads to better overall outcomes in the long term. So I really just emphasize especially when you face challenges, that's the best time to learn and to grow through the forge of that challenge.
It's the journey, not just the destination. As much as, you know, if you're like me, you like to tick places off that you've been to when you've been traveling the world. Actually, the journey is all part of that, all part of the journey as well. Brendan McMurtry, Vice President for FX Electronic Trading and Market Structure Analyst at T. Rowe Price. Thank you so much for joining us here today on CM Extra.
Thank you so much, David.
And that is it for today. A big thanks to all of our rising stars for sharing their stories. And if you know a rising star with a story to tell where you work, then do get in touch, as we'll be featuring more of the next generation of trading talent across our upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard today, a reminder that you can catch up on our previous episodes on AI in trading, leadership and culture, dealer wallet share, and much, much more on the-cmx.com. That's the-cmx.com, as well as in all the usual places you'll find your podcasts. Leave us some feedback, please. The CMX is the page on LinkedIn. It's a great place for that. And while you're there, perhaps tell us what you'd like us to cover in the future. And speaking of the future, some Finance Hive dates for your diary. December the 5th, 2024 is the FX Hive members meeting in London. January 23rd, 2025 is the Equities Hive members meeting, also in London. And then everybody, FI, FX and Equities, comes together for CMX 2024. Back at the Woolwich Works in London, and that is on Wednesday, the 2nd of July, 2025. Ignore any other dates that you might have seen. We're back on Wednesday, July the 2nd, 2025, for the big shindig that is CMX 2025. And if you want to find out more about Finance Hive or about any of those dates, then head over to the-cmx.com. But that is all for now from me, David, and from all of today's rising stars. Thanks for joining us. And until next time, bye-bye.